Our next speaker is Bill Doggett, and Bill's a respected and experienced lecturer, exhibitions curator, and archivist based in Oakland, California, and he is the namesake and nephew of the famous Philadelphia jazz pianist and organist Bill Doggett, whose centennial is next year, Bill's reminded me, in 2016. He's a cum laude Bachelor of Arts degree from UCLA and has been recognized by various municipal and state politicians and authorities for his work in the San Francisco area. He's the 2012 recipient of the Heritage Keepers Award for Exhibitions, Curation, and Archives by the Bay Area Friends of Negro Spirituals. As an exhibitor and archivist, he was invited to participate in both the 2014 and 2015 San Francisco Historical Society and Museum's 4th and 5th annual Bay Area-wide San Francisco History Expo. And Bill is going to speak about and present a portrait of Billy Strayhorn, an iconic Pittsburgh native son. Bill Doggett.
Good morning. It is truly an honor to be able to present today with all of the thought and all of the unexpected coincidence that Billy Strayhorn's centennial is not only 2015, but the fact that Billy Strayhorn was born in November 29th, 1915, and my own Bill Doggett, after whom I'm named, my uncle, was born only 4 months later in a neighboring town and of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and that both would go in 1938 to Harlem and New York and work as jazz pianists and arrangers, is quite the coincidence and quite the joy to be able to share. And the fact that my father, Bill's younger brother, John Doggett, would play saxophone in Bill's high school band in Philadelphia and almost also joined Billy Strayhorn and Bill Doggett in Harlem at the same year. So it's a very interesting thing. So Billy Strayhorn's very important. We have a lot of ground to cover. There's a lot in this particular presentation that pushes the envelope, but this is a portrait of Billy Strayhorn, an important, clear, unedited portrait of Billy Strayhorn, both in words and in sound and in his music. And so to set the tone, we'll begin with this wonderful introduction.
Train came out, man, it took the town by storm. It took, because people were dancing during that period, you know. It was just dynamite.
It's the Holy Grail. It identifies a population. It identifies a lifestyle, because it's the Harlem Renaissance, and it's unbelievable. It covers everything, and it says it all in 32 bars.
I'm sure he was thrilled that Ellington had chosen him. And Ellington, certainly. I mean, take the A-Train. Where would he be without the great signature song?
We didn't know that Sweet Pea had written A-Train. Everybody thought Duke had written it.
I have heard Take the A-Train, 10,000 times? To this day, it's hard for me to fully accept that it was a Strayhorn composition. But my God, this piece is so pure Ellington that it's really staggering.
Billy Strayhorn.
With Strayhorn as catalyst, Ellington ushered in what is arguably the greatest period of his career. He founded his own powerful music publishing company, Tempo Music, to bypass ASCAP. Take the A-Train has always been its greatest revenue producer. But Billy Strayhorn, its author, was still not on Ellington's payroll and received none of the song's royalties.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come-with-me places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails. The girls I knew had sad, sullen gray faces with distant gay traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day. 12 o'clock tales. I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life, of jazz and cocktails. The boys I knew had sad and sullen gray faces with distant gay traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day. 12 o'clock tales.
Quite an introduction, and also quite the statement. Billy Strayhorn reveals and gives us a window into his inner person and to his inner thinking through his words as well as his music. So I made a point of mixing and juxtaposing those two different versions, iconic versions of Lush Life, which we'll hear a little bit more later. So we begin. So who was Billy Strayhorn? Billy Strayhorn was born November 29, 1915, to Lillian Young and James Nathaniel Strayhorn in Dayton, Ohio. The Strayhorns moved to the Homewood section of Pittsburgh during World War I, where Billy's father found work. For generations dating back before the Civil War, Lillian Strayhorn's family roots were in Hillsboro, North Carolina, where the young Billy spent a lot of his time with his grandmother, sent there by his mother to protect him from the physical violence and abuse from his alcoholic father. It was in North Carolina in his grandmother's house that Billy began to play her piano and her Victrola, showing a precocious musical talent. Billy Strayhorn was the quiet but talented adolescent in Pittsburgh who his musical friends would call in 2015 terms a geek or nerd who kept to himself, never dated, or went to his junior high school or high school prom, but loved libraries, which were his source of inspiration and solace. Billy Strayhorn was to become Pittsburgh's famous gifted pianist, composer, uncredited and credited arranger, and ghostwriter for Duke Ellington Orchestra for 27 years, 1939 to 1967. Billy Strayhorn was the author of what would become one of American jazz, and in particular, Duke Ellington Orchestra's iconic logo in sound, Take the A-Train, and later other iconic Ellingtonia, including Satin Doll, Chelsea Bridge, Johnny Come Lately, Rain Check, Just a Sittin' and a Rockin', Daydream, Passion Flower, A Flower is a Lovesome Thing, and of course, Something to Live For. Mild-mannered, diminutive in stature, and nicknamed by Ellington band members as Sweet Pea, but staunchly protected as if a prize jewel by the Duke himself, Strayhorn was and remains, and importantly, the quiet, unassuming, first out gay black male musician in American jazz, intricately associated not only with the Ellington family, but the leading black jazz ensemble of the swing era, the Duke Ellington Orchestra. As Strayhorn biographer David Hygin notes, in his move to New York City and staying in the Ellington home, the Duke insisted that he stay in his home rather than where his first stop, which was the Manhattan Y. So in the Duke Ellington home in the posh Sugar Hill section of Harlem, it was Mercer Ellington, Duke's son, seeing that the young Strayhorn without any social friends, who introduced Strayhorn by chance to a neighbor whom Mercer barely knew, a black man by the name, a black man who happened to be a pianist and a musician as well, by the name of Aaron Bridgers. Yet Mercer Ellington, Billy Strayhorn, and Aaron Bridgers could not have known that this simple introduction would become a foundational, if not revolutionary, moment in the social dynamic in both the Harlem and the New York African-American and American jazz circles of the late 1930s and 40s, as by chance or by fate, Strayhorn and Bridgers would become the first black gay male couple publicly out decades ahead of their time, publicly comfortable being known as a couple to the Ellington family, the Ellington band, and Harlem jazz circles without making a political statement long before the Stonewall Uprising in New York City of 1969, long before Harvey Milk and the Castro gay rights movement of the 1970s, and long before the marriage equality movement of 2014 to the present day. Strayhorn was the lifelong friend and iconic platonic love of another Pittsburghian legend, Lena Horne. As Lena Horne has famously been quoted, if it could have been different, there was no greater love in her life than her first and lasting love for Billy Strayhorn. Lena Horne famously wanted to marry Billy Strayhorn because of their deep personal and professional bond. Strayhorn had a major impact on her singing technique, something that's, you know, that's hardly known, using his classical music training. Social progressives, both Lena Horne and Billy Strayhorn, would lend their services to the burgeoning civil rights movement of the early 1960s. In fact, Billy Strayhorn was a close friend of Dr. Martin Luther King. For purposes only of conjecture, had Lena Horne and Billy Strayhorn been inclined to create a false public image often marketed by Hollywood handlers of the 1940s, perhaps an arranged marriage for public image might have been an interesting turn for the marketing and branding of both Lena Horne and the Duke Ellington organization. But alas, so Strayhorn was and continues to be the important creative source in black Pittsburgh jazz circles, who gave important breaks to two fellow Pittsburgh jazz icons, Billy Eckstine and Earl Garner. It was in the 1937 and 38 revivals of Strayhorn's popular 1935 musical, Fantastic Rhythm, that Billy Eckstine is quoted by the biographer David Hygin, "I got my first big break as a singer, performing in Fantastic Rhythm. A second big break came when Strayhorn decided not to be the house pianist in the revival of his popular musical, and that was given to the young Pittsburgh pianist, Earl Garner. So Strayhorn was the gifted and trusting musician, grateful for his big break, who wanted only to please his new boss without a sense for a contractual business protocol, who agreed to come into the Ellington organization without a working contract, spelling out a position, a title, duties, or a contract that's stating the terms of payment for his arranging and composing services. And of course, for the payment of royalties, the songs that he would write, but Ellington would record. Alas, Billy Strayhorn was the Duke's personal prize compositional jewel, protected but also reviled in jealousy by other band members who questioned the Duke's embrace of this quiet, unseemly man who upended previous power relationships within the Ellington band. Most notably, from the beginning of the arrival of Billy Strayhorn, the existing balance of power was changed with the Ellington composer in residence, Juan Teasel. After all, it was Juan Teasel who had created the iconic Ellingtonia of Caravan, Pyramid, and Perdido. Strayhorn was a man who came to realize in his devotion to Ellington, he was also essentially stuck in a dynamic of a political power play regarding royalties and published name credits, which, if confronted early on, could have ended his career and blacklisted him for the rest of his creative life. While Strayhorn's many compositions premiered and recorded by the Duke Ellington Orchestra bore his name on the Victor 78 RPM label, the issue of royalties would remain an issue until 1946, when Strayhorn won the coveted Esquire Hot Jazz Music Award. Yet against this unseeming backdrop of professional complications, Billy Strayhorn was one of the greatest compositional voices and American songwriters since the death of George Gershwin in 1937, an exceptional pianist, composer, and arranger, the junior composer, if not ghostwriter, for Untold Ellingtonia, an underappreciated revolutionary force in American jazz decades ahead of his time as a first closeted, then out black gay man in what was a particularly homophobic environment of an all-black male jazz band in the 1930s and 40s, heavily marketed and branded with a virile and suavecito heterosexual commercial image, which was, of course, the Duke Ellington Orchestra, more so than the Count Basie Orchestra, the two leading, if I can just, I'm ad-libbing on here, the two leading images of African-American black swing orchestras of the late 30s and 40s are, of course, the Duke Ellington Orchestra and Count Basie in particular. Certainly there's Jimmy Lunsford, but it's Duke Ellington and Count Basie. So it's very interesting. So going back, so Strayhorn was unique, if not groundbreaking, in being respected for his musical genius versus his sexual orientation, a composite of multiple skill sets indispensable to Duke Ellington, without whom the legacy of the Duke Ellington brand, and I'm going to repeat that, without whom the legacy of the Duke Ellington brand of 1940 to 1967 would not have been as successfully positioned. In essence, from my perspective in 2015, Billy Strayhorn's life and legacy are revolutionary for pushing the envelope of possibilities against a backdrop of a mission impossible. So where does it all begin? In the words and in the music of the young 16-year-old Billy Strayhorn, in 1933, in the unpublished, privately performed Song of Songs, an autobiographical anthem first called Life is Lonely, later renamed to Lush Life. Strayhorn, in his youth and throughout his life, provided a critical window, as I've been saying before, into the inner life through his words and the lyrics. Lush Life, begun at age 16, was not completed until 1948, was never publicly performed until a Carnegie Hall performance with Duke Ellington Orchestra, where Kay Davis was the vocalist. Lush Life was and remains a gem of mature creative genius, and there has been controversy for decades about what this song is really all about. In your handouts, if you pick them up, the words, I printed out the words to Lush Life and another song, Something to Live For. So the controversy has been for years. Many people have interpreted it different ways. In my work, as Rick Marlowe introduced me, I'm from Los Angeles. My family's from Philadelphia. I'm from Los Angeles. But when I moved to the Bay Area, I had brought with me some of the social ministry background of my father and the leadership skills, that my father being the late Reverend John Doggett of Philadelphia, but who was also heavily involved with the Western Christian Leadership Conference, the West Coast end of SCLC. And close friend of Martin Luther King. So I picked up, you know, by osmosis, if you will, some of the leadership skills. So I took some of that to the Bay Area. And by 2008, I had the opportunity to be appointed to the to one of the advisory committees of the Human Rights Commission of the City and County of San Francisco. And in my work there on this committee, I had a chance to do some outreach. Basically, I call it essentially social ministry work, to men who were in 12-step programs, who were in substance abuse, dealing with HIV, et cetera. And I played music as an intergenerational bridge to create dialogue. And three of the songs I played were Strayhorn, Lush Life, Something to Live For, and then Duke Ellington's iconic Mood Indigo. So it's very interesting to look at this song for what it's about. What is it, you know, what is he saying here? You know, because we have, for the interest of time, you know, I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails. The girls I knew had sad and sullen gray faces with distinguished traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day 12 o'clock tales. How does a 16-year-old know this? How could a 16-year-old even imagine this? Well, as David Hagen, the critical biographer, has noted, it was a fantasy. Billy Strayhorn, known to his friends, never went out, never dated, was essentially asexual in the 1930s from their perception. Of course, later on it was revealed that, you know, he was just basically what's termed today closeted. He was afraid to be seen or out. There, et cetera, so forth. There's a whole lot around this, but I won't go into it. So how does it happen? Well, he obviously spent a lot of time in libraries. He obviously went to the movies. So it was really, if you will, a projected fantasy of a life that he had not yet experienced but could relate to and yet managed to coin and capture and bottle in a way that only someone perhaps 45, 50, or 60 with a lot of love experience, someone like maybe a Noel Coward, or Dorothy Parker, who had been so much further along, or even, let's say, a Bertolt Brecht. You know, if you look at the lyrics in Brecht's Three-Penny Opera, I mean, that's, you know, here's a 16-year-old Billy Strayhorn revealing that kind of maturity. So let's move on here, because I want to go and have you listen to this particular version. Nancy Wilson focuses on the words like no other version. I think this is interesting to hear.
Used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life, of jazz and cocktails. The boys I knew had sad and sullen gray faces with distant gay traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day 12 o'clock days. Then you came along with your silent song to tempt me to madness. I thought for a while that your poignant smile was tinged with the sadness of a great love for me. Ah, yes, I was wrong. Again, I was wrong.
And we have to leave it there because of the fact of time. So fast forward to 1935, the talented teenager and star musician at Pittsburgh's Westinghouse High School, Strayhorn was tasked to create a musical play titled Fantastic Rhythm, as you're seeing right up here on the screen. Fantastic Rhythm was so well received that it took on a life of its own, revivals in main stage theaters in Pittsburgh in 1937-38. Yet Strayhorn could not get a big break yet. Already having studied leading black jazz pianists, Teddy Wilson and Art Tatum for Style and Improvisation through their 78 RPM records, several well-connected jazz musician friends of his positioned the idea that he should have a private meeting with one of the big swing bands touring through Pittsburgh. The first idea, of course, was Count Basie, and in this is the January 30th, 1937, Pittsburgh Courier, the leading black newspaper. This is in my collection. This is the music section of it. See, here you have Count Basie, you know, coming to the city's chatterbox. Here you have all of this interest in stuff going in New York, and Ella Fitzgerald and Chick Webb coming to Apollo, and etc. But the main prize, of course, in New York would be Duke Ellington. So fate should have it that the Duke Ellington Orchestra was booked to play a week at Pittsburgh Stanley Theater beginning in December 1st, 1938. After the band's performance on December 2nd, Gus Greeley, the well-connected uncle of Billy's musician friend George Greeley, announced to the Duke that he had a musician he just had to meet. The Duke agreed, and Strayhorn entered, sat down at the piano, began performing to exact perfection and nuance, as Duke had performed earlier in the evening, two iconic Ellingtonian works. Sophisticated Lady and In My Solitude, first as a Duke performer, and then showcasing a reharmonized change key and tempo version of the compositions that he had never seen the original score for. Of course, the Duke was impressed beyond belief and invited him to visit his apartment in New York, giving him subway directions from which the famous story emerges of how the Take the A Train came to life. Strayhorn, indebted and determined to impress Duke Ellington, writes a ready-to-go-to-press, fully composed with lyrics, Take the A Train, and performs it for the Duke. What is amazing about the A Train, I'm going to go through my PowerPoint coming up, yes. What is amazing about the A Train creation story is that not only did Strayhorn seek to impress the Duke with his seriousness about being an arranger, he also modeled his perceived new role as house arranger for the Duke Ellington Band after his role model, Fletcher Henderson, who had already become the all-important in-house arranger for Benny Goodman. Responsible for Benny Goodman's great hits. So we arrive at the core repertoire of Billy Strayhorn. In your handouts, these are listed. Take the A Train, Satin Doll, Chelsea Bridge, Daydream, Johnny Come Lately, A Flower is a Lonesome Thing, etc. and so forth, and the final composition, Blood Count, which was a final composition that referenced his illness, which he was diagnosed with throat cancer and died eventually of throat cancer. The extended compositions, look at this. Collaborated with Ellington on the Perfume Suite, the Deep South Suite, Such Sweet Thunder, A Drum is a Woman, Nutcracker Suite, Peer Gynt, Far East Suite. Amazing. So let's listen to Billy Strayhorn, Johnny Come Lately. So the question is it Ellington or is it Strayhorn? Is it Strayhorn or is it Ellington? Johnny Come Lately has for decades been part of the Ellingtonian fabric. I mean, it's iconically Ellingtonian, but yet it is Strayhorn. Fortunately, as you saw in that initial recording, Strayhorn was credited if you can see on the screen, Clementine was another Strayhorn, and this was the original 78. This is from my collection. Next one, we'll just for a hot second listen to this because we're short on time. This is Clementine. Kind of sounds like Ellington, doesn't it? Well, of course, because while Strayhorn lived in Duke Ellington's apartment for the first 2 months, he made a point of studying his scores. It was his goal to match and to blend his own compositional gift with that of the sound and the structure of Duke Ellington. So let's move on. Rain Check, another song. These are from my own collection. Passion Flower, very famous. Of course, Chelsea Bridge, Something to Live For. I have a sample of Chelsea Bridge, but we're not going to have time to play it today. Take the A Train, the famous recording. This is the original issue. And then, of course, the war effort, the Vetus. And this is interesting because in here you have Perfume Suite, Esquire Swank, and Kissing Bug, all basically Strayhorn compositions, but Strayhorn is shares, you know, the credits here, as you can see on the labels, with Ellington. Moving forward, again, Strayhorn later, of course, works with other sidemen in the Ellington Orchestra. Johnny Hodges, he wrote Lot 4, much of the, you know, Chelsea Bridge is a Johnny Hodges showpiece, if you will. Flowers and Lonesome Thing is as well. Billy Strayhorn obviously got his own orchestra, also on the Sunrise label. There's also he recorded for Mercer Ellington's label. So we move on to looking at this as we're coming closer to the end. So Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington are really inseparable, but Billy Strayhorn, how happy was Billy Strayhorn? Look at the detail on the bottom of this picture, this publicity picture that you don't see, which comes from one of the many jazz books I have. He doesn't look that happy. He's staying straight ahead. The publicity picture, he's happy and buoyant, but I don't think he was that happy. He recognized at that moment, or had recognized that, you know, he's in the picture, by the way, is Cy Oliver, who was working with Tommy Dorsey, the Duke, and then, of course, Billy Strayhorn. It's really quite a question. But yet, by this time, the 1946 Esquire Jazz Awards, Strayhorn and Ellington are both jazz winners, and this is from the original 12-inch 78 on RCA Victor, which is from my collection. So we move on to, as we come to our closing, here is Strayhorn. Picture Strayhorn as the devoted arranger, devoted Ellingtonian, the in-house close person and friend, and Brand, Junior Brand, or Ghost Brand of Duke Ellington. And of course, some of the many different sessions he recorded with. And then in this picture, as we close, this is a very interesting picture, of course. This is the first picture and the only known picture, apparently, of Strayhorn with his first partner, Aaron Bridges, who was a pianist and a composer, and with Billie Holiday. Billie Holiday is also, of course, more famously, 2015 is the Billie Holiday Centennial. So this is an interesting picture, as well as a picture in Harlem of Billy Strayhorn and his partner at a Harlem party. Look at the difference in how the public image and then the personal image. It's very interesting. So, and this is a picture taken at Billy Strayhorn's apartment in 1966, 6 months before he died, with his last partner of 3 years, Bill Grove. And the final picture. This is Billy Strayhorn already ill. This was his Christmas card, photo Christmas card and New Year's card that's done in 1966, basically 4.5 months before he died. And this really says a lot. The picture, the classic term, a picture has 1,000 words, is 1,000 words. So what does it say? May the new year be as good to you as you were kind to me during my illness. Look at this image of Billy Strayhorn. We come full circle. Billy Strayhorn is now publicly showing himself at a bar, at his favorite bar in New York, a gay bar. And the meaning of Lush Life becomes even more prominent. A song that he had written as a 16-year-old, as a fantasy, actually becomes a reality. He was happy, but he had a journey that reflected the interior feeling of a song that he had begun as a fantasy and an experience of a fantasy of a life that was actually to come later. So as we finish and I close this quick but interesting portrait of Billy Strayhorn on his centennial year, let us enjoy this really poignant eulogy, if you will, of image and sound married to a very iconic and very important song, as important as Lush Life, called Something to Live For. If you have the handouts, it's printed on the last page. Thank you.
deerskin rugs to lie before my fire. But there's something missing. Something isn't there. It seems I'm never kissing the one whom I could care for.
Thank you very much.